From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. There's a new tribute album to Neil Diamond featuring covers of his songs by other singers. On today's Fresh Air, we feature an interview with Neil Diamond. He started his career writing songs for other singers. When he had a few takers, he ended up making his own songs famous. Also, actress Angie Dickinson. She played opposite the leading men Frank Sinatra, John Wayne, Lee Marvin, Burt Reynolds, and Roger Moore. In the mid-70s, she starred in the TV series Policewoman, which has now been collected on DVD. And film critic David Edelstein reviews Army of Shadows, the 1969 French film about the French Resistance. It's being released in the U.S. for the first time. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross.
Girl, you'll be a woman soon. I love you so much, can't count all the ways I died for you, girl, and all they can say is, he's not your kind. Then I saw her face.
That was Urge Overkill, The Four Tops, UB40, Bobby Womack, and Shane McGowan and the Popes. They're all featured on the new CD Forever Neil Diamond, a tribute album of songs by our guest, Neil Diamond. Diamond started out writing songs for a music publishing company in hopes that someone would record them. He wrote the Monkees' number one hit, I'm a Believer. But it was Diamond himself who made most of his own songs famous. Songs like Solitary Man, Cherry Cherry, Sweet Caroline, and Girl, You'll Be a Woman Soon. As a lot of his contemporaries fell off the charts, Diamond moved from teen pop to adult pop. He recorded a duet with Barbara Streisand, had hits from his remake of The Jazz Singer, and dressed in spangles for sold-out concerts. In 2005, he recorded a CD of new songs that was intentionally unglitzy. It was produced by Rick Rubin, who recorded Johnny Cash's musically and emotionally naked final albums. Terry spoke with Neil Diamond last year.
I think it's fair to say your first big break, correct me if I'm wrong, was when you had recorded a demo, and the songwriters Ellie Greenwich and Jeff Barry heard the demo and they really liked you. And they, some of their songs are Do Do Run Run, Chapel of Love.
Be My Baby.
Be My Baby, yeah. So how did they hear you?
I was making a demo. Usually when you sold a song to a publisher, they would allow you to go in and make your own demo, which was an invaluable experience to me. But I went and made the demo and hired Ellie as a backup singer, which she did, despite the fact that she was having huge hits. She liked to sing in the studios with the other girls, and so I hired her for this session, and she liked something about what I was doing, my writing or my singing, and she brought me to her husband, Jeff, and he liked something about what I was doing. I don't know if he liked the writing or the singing, but one liked one and the other one liked the other. So we started a working relationship. We were both working for the same music publisher, and I kind of got let go by that music publisher, and I asked Jeff and Ellie if they were interested in producing me.
In the first session that you did with them, you recorded Solitary Man. Did you like the idea of horns on this?
I like the idea of anything on those records. I was just thrilled to be there.
Well, let's hear Solitary Man, which I have to say, I think it's really a terrific recording.
Thank you.
Yeah, so, okay, let's hear it. This is your first hit, yes?
Yes,
you
can
recorded
call it
yourself.
A hit.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is Neil Diamond, Solitary Man.
The Linda was mine till the time that I found her, holding Jim, loving him. Then Sue came along, loved me strong, that's what I thought, me and Sue, that I do.
Diamond. Now, did you write this song for yourself or for somebody else?
No, I wrote this for myself. I had a contract with Jeff and Ellie, and I started to focus in on just what I wanted to do. And so Solitary Man was written for me and for the first sessions that I was to do with Jeff and Ellie.
There's this, like, urgency in the song and in the way you sing it. And I think of you in a way as kind of specializing in some of your work in that urgency. Some of the music on your new CD, 12 Songs, too, has that just really urgent sound to it. Is that something you've been conscious of that you think really, like, works especially well for you as a songwriter and as a singer?
Well, I can tell you that I wasn't conscious of it until you just mentioned it. I've never thought of my songs having that sense of urgency, but I'll listen again and maybe as an objective observer, you can pick up on that stuff. But I never felt that there was an urgency, a sense of drama, a sense of yearning, lots of things, but not urgency. But you may be very right about this. I'm going to listen again now.
So how did Solitary Man change your idea of what you wanted from your musical life?
Once I had a chart record of my own, I was no longer a kid knocking around on the streets. I was now, we didn't call them artists at that time. We called them vocalists, but I was a vocalist. It was a whole different thing. I was writing for myself, so I had to really dig in and write as well as I possibly could. And I have to say, before that time, I don't know if I was doing that. I was just writing and writing and writing, maybe just to get an advance from a publisher. But there was not a lot of me in those songs. And Solitary Man was the first of a long line of me songs, my experience songs.
When you were working in the rock and roll Tin Pan Alley, were you actually, and you were writing for music publishers, were you actually going to an office building every day to write?
When I was signed to a staff publishing company, a music company, I would go in as often as I possibly could. The subway train from Brighton Beach, where I live, that took us to New York University, went also a few more stops further to Tin Pan Alley. So there was a lot of cutting of classes, going up and trying to peddle the newest song, probably that I had written in one of the classes at school. So it was an attraction. It was a seduction that was just a couple of stops beyond NYU, and I unfortunately spent a lot of time skipping that the NYU 8th Street stop and going up to the 49th Street stop, which is where Tin Pan Alley was, and that was great fun too.
Now, were these several buildings? Was it just the Brill Building or 1620 Broadway also?
Well, 1650 Broadway.
1650, yeah, sorry, yeah.
That's all right. Yes, the Brill Building, but there were dozens and maybe hundreds of other music publishing companies in that area, in all kinds of buildings. It was that era when rock and roll had just come in, and anybody could get a listening to their music because the publishers didn't understand what rock and roll was, and they were willing to listen to anybody and sign anybody that they thought might have the vaguest chance of having some success. So it was an open game for a number of years. But then things got serious. I got married. I was having a baby on the way, and I had to get serious. Enough with this fun.
Now, the Monkees did a couple of your songs, I'm a Believer and A Little Bit Me, A Little Bit You. Did you write those with them in mind or for yourself? I'm trying to think of what the chronology was. Like, you start recording in, what, like, 67?
66.
66, okay. And what year are the Monkees? Like, is that after that?
I think 67, something like that. I had recorded a couple of songs, including Solitary Man and Cherry Cherry, which was a big hit. And because of that hit, the people who were producing the Monkees called and said, we like Cherry Cherry. Do you have any other songs? I said, well, I don't have anything like Cherry Cherry, but I have an album coming out soon, and I'll send it over and take your pick.
You know, it's funny. The common wisdom goes when telling the story of, like, songwriters from the Brill Building and the Beatles is that the Beatles changed everything. After the Beatles band started writing their own songs, it drove out the professional songwriters. But, of course, the Monkees are a band that's, you know, a kind of fabricated band copying the Beatles. And you have this tremendous success writing for them. And in that sense, like, the Beatles' success inadvertently really helped you as a songwriter.
Oh, yeah, no question about it. But it was not only in the sense of the Monkees doing a couple of songs. It was in the sense that the doors began to open for songwriters who were able to sing. And I just happened to be one of them who'd been knocking around the streets for years and now suddenly was getting a new and fresh listening to my work. So the Beatles made an enormous change, as did Bob Dylan. They brought the songwriter up to the front of the line and said, you know, you guys do it. And it had a devastating effect on the music publishing business in Tin Pan Alley. But it opened up many doors for people like me.
My guest is Neil Diamond. Here's his version of I'm a Believer.
Someone else, but not for me. Love was out to get me. That's the way it seems. Disappointing, haunted all my dreams. Then I saw her face. Now I'm a believer. Not a trace. Doubt my mind. I'm in love. I'm a believer, I couldn't leave her if I tried.
Neil Diamond. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with Neil Diamond. A new tribute album of his songs performed by other artists has just been released. It's called Forever Neil Diamond.
I want to ask you about another of your songs, and this is also an earlier song. It's Girl, You'll Be a Woman Soon, and the Urge Overkill version of this was used by Quentin Tarantino in Pulp Fiction. How did you find out that Quentin Tarantino was going to use a version of this song for Pulp Fiction?
Well, first they have to request the right to use it. There's no general license for that. Each one has to be requested and negotiated and either agreed or not agreed on. But I got a request and a part of a script to be used in this movie called Pulp Fiction. And I've always held to a very tenuous line as to what I wanted my songs to be used as, and I wouldn't let them be used in cigarette commercials or alcohol commercials. And this script that I read was way out there. It was beyond what I would turn down normally, and I did turn it down. I heard almost immediately from my publisher, who said, you know, you shouldn't turn this down. This guy's a tremendous director, and you should just do it and let them do it, which I did. And, of course, I've never regretted it because it was an entirely different way of seeing that song. But that's basically how it happened.
So what did you think of the movie?
Oh, I loved the movie. I was amazed by the movie. I've seen it.
How come you loved the movie but didn't love the script? What was different actually seeing it?
Well, I didn't get the whole script. I only got a few pages of the script in which the song would be used. And I don't know if you remember the scene, but she was, Uma Thurman was very heavily into a coke binge, and she went unconscious and had to be taken for some quote-unquote special treatment. It just seemed too strong for my own taste. And it was a lesson that I learned, you know. See who else is working on it. See how serious they are. Don't take it at face value, and don't take your prejudices into this kind of discussion.
Well, why don't we hear your version of the song? Here it is.
Great.
Girl, you'll be your woman soon. Love you so much, can't count all the ways I'd die for you, girl, and all they can say is, he's not your kind. They never get tired of putting me down, and I never know when I come around what I'm gonna find. Don't let them make up your mind. Don't you know, girl, you'll be a woman soon. Please come take my hand.
One of the things that has kept you musically successful over the decades is your tours. Would you describe a little bit how you put together your idea of what a show should be?
It's a good question. I've never worked with a director. I like to put the shows together myself with the help of a lot of other people, including the band, my band, who've been with me for many years. And we start right at the beginning. I have a huge blackboard in the studio, and we start with the songs that I want to include and that we haven't included in previous shows. I try to find a good opening song, a good closing song, which is usually, traditionally for me, has been Brother Love's Traveling Salvation Show, because it kind of sums up what I'm about and what I'd like the world to be about. And you fill in and you try to make something interesting, and each song has to have something that's new and fresh and original about it, even if it was written 30 years ago.
What about figuring out what to wear for your shows?
I never thought about it. I have a clothing designer. His name is Bill Whitten. He's been doing my stage clothes for 35 years now. And so I let Bill take the lead in that. I have comments, obviously, things I like and don't like. But Bill handles that, and I think he decided in the mid-70s that he wanted to go with glass beading and sparkly kind of things, basically, I think, because no one else was using it, and it would become mine. So, okay, I tried it, and I think it worked very well, although it's become a point of contention. I mean, just the fact that you bring it up is what has been happening over the years. I'll get a review for a show, and they'll think the show is wonderful, but they'll put down the shirt, which is terrific. I'd rather have them put down the shirt than something important. But I've been wearing those kind of shirts, and now it's tapering off now. But the shirts have been part of my persona on stage for as long as I can remember.
Neil Diamond speaking last year with Terry Gross. Here's Neil Diamond from his recent CD, 12 Songs, which was produced by Rick Rubin. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Pretty soon we were taking it serious, me and you underneath a mysterious spell. Nothing I could do, and it suddenly felt like a bolt out of hell. Telling you, to the sound of the beat I was hanging on, like a powerful truth it was banging on me. Wouldn't let me go, like a shot in the dark. She was hot like a spark. I only know, neither one of us trying to hold it down, neither one of us taking the middle ground. Wasn't how to make sense we were thinking of, just the two of us bent on delirious love. Me and you being spent on delirious love, like a ride on a rocket it took us up. Didn't want it to stop and it shook us up good. We were moving fast, just ahead of the law, we were begging for more.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Nathaniel Hawthorne's The Scarlet Letter, available in stores and online at bn.com. From Turner Classic Movies, presenting Race and Hollywood, Black Images on Film, a 38-film retrospective with discussion and commentary Tuesday and Thursday nights in May. And from the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, a policewoman who hung with the Rat Pack. We hear from actress Angie Dickinson, who co-starred in the original Ocean's 11 and starred in the 1970s TV show Policewoman. It's now collected on DVD. Also, David Edelstein reviews Army of Shadows, the 1969 film about the French Resistance being released in the U.S. for the first time. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. The 1970s series Policewoman has emerged on DVD, featuring veteran actress Angie Dickinson playing the sexy vice cop Pepper Anderson. Though she was in her 40s when the series opened, Dickinson spent much of her time impersonating hookers, going undercover in women's prisons, and acting as bait for sexual predators. Dickinson won a Golden Globe Award for the role. Here she is playing a prostitute, having a drink with a hustler, Carl, played by Joseph Campanella. He's trying to get her in on his traveling casino ring.
Ah, relax.
You want to get me stoned out of my head before I pick up your marks?
We got time. Then we might have a little fun before you, huh?
Forget it.
Come on.
We don't need it.
I know what I need.
Not me, not now.
Yeah, you, now.
Oh, come on, Carl. Are we in business or in high school? Okay.
Angie Dickinson is a former beauty queen who began acting in the mid-50s. Her breakout role came in the film Rio Bravo, where she played opposite John Wayne. She also starred with Lee Marvin in The Killers and Point Blank, Burt Reynolds in Sam Whiskey, and Roger Moore in The Sins of Rachel Cade. Terry spoke to Angie Dickinson in 2001, when the remake of the film Ocean's 11 was released. Dickinson starred in the original Ocean's 11, made in 1960, as the estranged wife of Frank Sinatra, who leads a band of men planning to rob casinos. In this scene, Sinatra is trying to reconnect with Dickinson after years of separation.
Now just sit there and don't interrupt me. I've got a very big deal going on. Large chips, carloads of them.
That sounds familiar.
That might be so, but this time it's true.
Oh, good. I like to have rich friends.
This is one rich friend who wants to spend a bundle on you.
Gee, thanks.
Okay, that's settled. On the morning of January the 2nd, I'm going to pick you up. I'm going to hop down to Rio, so you pack a bag.
You're serious? I honestly think you're serious.
Of course I'm serious.
A week's trip to Rio?
Yes.
Oh, Danny, what a prize you are. The only husband in the world who'd proposition his own wife.
What was it like to work with Sinatra on the set, since you already knew him? I don't know whether you were just friends then, or were you whether you already had a deeper relationship.
He was, I think he was seeing Juliet Prowse during this time. I'm almost positive about that. So that was good, because it doesn't work very well when you're romantic, because things can happen at home and interfere on the set and vice versa. So we were just friends at that time.
Why do you think the guys in the Rat Pack needed a group? I mean, a lot of people like to be loners. But there was a period when, you know, Sinatra and Sammy Davis Jr., Dean Martin, Peter Lawford, they hung together and they were identified together.
I think Frank always liked company. You were not one of his favorites if you didn't hang in there. He was a nightclub person. He was a late person all his life, and he did not want to stay up late alone. Whereas Dean Martin was very much a loner. He liked going home, not necessarily alone, but not with a bunch around him, maybe a lady or one friend. But Frank always enjoyed the more the merrier if they were his pals. And Sammy liked people around him. I think that came from the stage and nightclub where you're basically entertaining all the time.
When you were romantically involved with Sinatra, was it ever annoying to have him always want to be in a crowd?
No, it's not even a matter of wanting to be in a crowd. He just didn't want to be alone.
Right, but wanting to have, like, good friends surrounding him, yeah.
Yes, I was, I'm one of these that says, I mean, all right, already we saw them last night. Can't we just see somebody else tonight? He had a tendency to stay with people that he was safe with, very comfortable with, and, you know, no facade. And so he found that very protective. Since I didn't need that, I was not a Sinatra, and there was only one, we'll never know what it's like to be watched every breath you take and analyzed and criticized and judged or adored. So he needed that shield of friends around him where he could totally be himself and not feel ogled. And so I understood that, but I'm more the loner.
Well, you ended up, after you had worked for a few years, starring in a great Western, Rio Bravo, which was directed by Howard Hawks. It also starred John Wayne, Dean Martin, and Ricky Nelson.
Yeah, and Walter Brennan,
Who
practically made the movie. I know he's not billed as one of the stars, but boy, didn't he make it special. That's a very good example of the woman's role was almost always just, I used to call it, waving goodbye to the husband on the horse or running into his arms when he came back. And that was the typical role for a woman in a Western, with the exception of Destry Rides Again, Marlene Dietrich, and Feathers in Rio Bravo. She was very, very, very much her own again, and didn't cower around the men. She held her own, and it was early in the feminist type of view. Howard Hawks was very well known for making all of his women quite strong, whether it was Westerns or I Was a Male War Bride or Bringing Up Baby. He liked strong women. He married strong women.
What's your favorite scene in Rio Bravo?
Well, the favorite scene that I had to do was the last scene where Duke is comes up, and I don't know what he comes up to see me for, and he sees me in this rather risque outfit. He says, "What are you doing in that?" And she says, "I'm going down to sing." She says, "You didn't know I could sing, did you?" He says, "You're not going down there in that outfit." And she starts to cry. "I thought you'd never say it." He said, "Say what?" And she says, "That you love me." And he says, "I didn't say that." She says, "Yes, you did. You just don't know it yet." And it's just wonderful.
Well, why don't we hear that scene?
Okay.
Where are you going?
Downstairs.
You better not.
Why had I better not?
Because I'm still sheriff. You wear those things in public, I'll arrest you.
Oh, John T. I've waited so long for you to say that. I thought you were never... You have the funniest way of saying things. Just when
Laura,
I think you're going to say one thing, you say
now.
Something
Get
else.
Get those darn things off. I'll wait outside.
No. You don't have to go. I can use the screen. Besides, I want you to stay here because the other thing is all over now, isn't it? I'm trying to hurry, but I'm all thumbs. What I had to go through, put on these tights, ask a lot of questions, start to walk out. I thought you were never going to say it.
Say what?
That you loved me.
I said I'd arrest you.
It means the same thing. You know that. You just won't say it.
A scene from Rio Bravo with John Wayne and Angie Dickinson. In The Killers, you start opposite Lee Marvin. Ronald Reagan was the heavy in that. I think it was the last movie that he made. Were you surprised when he became president?
You know, with all due respect, and I do adore President Reagan, and saw him on, I would say, 6 or 7 social occasions after he was president and while he was president, but very surprised when he became president, yes. He was... since that was his last, he did that film because he had a contract to satisfy. He owed Universal one more picture, and they said, "This is it." And he said, "Okay, get it over with." He didn't like the movie at all, and his character, and rightly so, but he just wanted to end that contract and get on with politics. So he was studying all the time on The Killers. He was always reviewing and delving into huge piles of paper. He was on his way to become governor then. And I was most surprised, yes. Although he couldn't have been lovelier on the set, he just didn't strike me as presidential material, but he sure was.
Did you vote for him?
I did not vote for Ronnie, I'm sorry. I'm a Democrat.
Did it still hurt to not vote for a friend?
Yes, it does. You don't feel like a traitor, but it's a little harder to put that X down opposite him. Yes, because I really liked him and always did like him. I always liked Nancy very much. Used to run into her because we all lived in Brentwood, and used to run into her in the store, and she was always so nice, but I still was loyal.
Angie Dickinson speaking with Terry Gross. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2001 interview with actress Angie Dickinson.
You got cast as the star on the TV series Policewoman, which a series you did for about 4 years. You played Sergeant Pepper Anderson, a divorced woman working undercover. This is a pretty groundbreaking series because you had like a woman action hero starring in prime time.
It was absolutely groundbreaking. There was none before. And that's why I mentioned the date, is because I just happened to look it up the other day and I realized that I had not re-emerged yet in 74. I did when I came on with the show, but that was around September or so. The only shows that succeeded to star a woman were the comedies. And this was the first drama starring a woman, our show, and the first cop that succeeded. There were a couple of other attempts that they died off right away. So I'm very proud of that.
How did it affect your personal life to do TV for 4 years?
It broke it. they don't even do what I did anymore because they have more of a team. It's just virtually impossible to do what I did, to be in everything and to work 12 hours a day and every day. So I had no social life. I didn't see a foreign movie for 5 years. I look at that. I used to love to go to the best movies, and that was my criterion to say I never had the extra time to go take in a foreign movie in all that time. So I lost friends, lost a husband. My daughter still talks about how lonely she was for 4 years while I was at work. So it takes a terrible toll.
The husband you lost is when you broke up with Burt Bacharach.
Oh, yeah, but I would have lost him anyway because we weren't going to make it. But it contributed to it early.
Angie Dickinson, you started acting in the 1950s. Of all the different fashion eras that you've worked through, what were some of the best and worst trends in clothing, hair, and makeup? Some of the best and worst.
The 50s were the pits. The 50s for the clothes was the worst. The 50s for the hair was the worst. We all looked like Esther Williams. I certainly did. And
Bouffant hair?
No, Bouffant didn't come till the 60s.
Well, those tight curls, is that what you mean?
Yeah, tight curls.
Yeah, yeah.
And Doris Day, we all, I mean, you're hard-pressed sometimes to say, is that Lana Turner or is that me? Because the hairstyles and the clothes were so similar. There was no individuality and no rebellion yet. So the 60s for the clothes, for the men, was great. That was the first time with the Beatles wearing their hair, quote, long, which was not long. But they had sideburns and long hair. And then for costume, they had beads and Nehru jackets and wild colors and bell-bottom pants. And the miniskirt was the greatest change for somebody who had some good-looking legs. And they were good on women without great-looking legs. It was just wonderfully revolutionary. You now could be an individual with your hair and your wardrobe.
They wore those pale lipsticks in the 60s, those pale pinks.
Yeah, I always wore the pale lipstick. I don't even know what I wore in the 50s, but in the 60s, that was certainly my era. And I know Jose Ibert, the great hairdresser, he says, you and Anne Margaret, you never change. You're in the same makeup all these years, and it always looks great. I'm not sure how great I look in it, but I just can't let go of that. And I wear pale lipstick because I look dreadful in dark lipstick. There's only one reason why I wear it.
How did you become a blonde?
I became a blonde because I was doing a movie, newly under contract to Warner Brothers. This might interest you as the feminist kind of aura of human rights. Howard Hawks finished Rio Bravo, and he put me under contract for it, of course. And I was thrilled to be under contract to Howard Hawks. Then he asked for a 9-month postponement, or a 6-month postponement, I think it was, before he started paying me. And I had to give it to him, of course, because it was about a year after the movie was made that it was released. And one day, my agent told me I was going to get a part, a test for a part in The Bramble Bush at Warner Brothers. And I said, oh, great. So I went to the studio, and I said, hi, I'm Angie, and I'm here to test for something on stage 8. And they said, we'll get your pass for you. You've got your permanent pass right here. And I said, no, I'm just coming to screen test. They said, no, you've got a permanent pass. It's right here. I said, what do you mean? He says, you're under contract here. And that's how I found out from the guard at the gate that I was sold by Howard Hawks to Warner Brothers, which did not make me happy. And so I got the part, but since Barbara Rush was a brunette, and I was a brunette, they, of course, couldn't have two women the same color. They blonded my hair.
And that
it seems so silly to me because, but that's how they, it was a very ordinary movie and not very good. And it stuck. I got to like it and I kept it.
But, you know, it's true. Like, actresses used to be seen as like the blonde or the brunette. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was such, it was seen as such an important defining characteristic.
Yes. Well, above all, you must not mix them up.
Right.
Now, I don't think I look anything like Barbara Rush at all. But when you think back, I must say, I go to some movies now and I say, I think that's so-and-so, or is it so-and-so? They look quite a bit alike. So perhaps the producer was right, but it certainly worked out fine for me because the blonde did, it worked better for me. I had very icky dark brown hair. Still do.
Now, let me ask you, you eventually ended up insuring your legs with Lloyd's of London for $1 million. And that got a lot of publicity. Was that a studio publicity stunt, or did they actually need you to insure your legs?
No, they insured my legs because this was when I was after Warner Brothers' contract and I finished that or got out of it. Then I went to Universal. I was auditioning for the role of Gregory Peck's romantic interest in Captain Newman, M.D., and they said, you will get the part if you sign a 7-year contract. And I thought, oh, God, here we go again. Get stuck in stupid movies for 7 years. But I had no choice. I wanted that movie, and it was a real coup at the time. So I accepted that. And so now they had to build me as a star if I was going to be worth my weight. And so they would do different tricks. And one of them was to insure my legs. So I said, now, you guys, is this legitimate or is this just a gag? And they said, no, it's legitimate, but just don't ask us how long. So I suppose they insured them for the minimal amount of time, whether it was a week, an hour, or a day. I'm sure it wasn't for more than a week.
Right.
But it worked very nicely. It was very good publicity. They were pretty legs, and there is something about pretty legs.
Angie Dickinson, thank you so much for talking with us.
Terry, I loved it.
Angie Dickinson speaking with Terry Gross. Dickinson's 1970s TV series Policewoman has just come out on DVD. Coming up, David Edelstein on the French film Army of Shadows. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
The distributor Rialto Pictures has made a name for itself with beautifully restored theatrical reissues of important classic films, among them Renoir's Grand Illusion, Fellini's Knights of Cabiria, The Battle of Algiers, and even the original Japanese-language Godzilla. They've also drawn attention to less well-known masterworks, including Carol Reed's Fallen Idol, and now Jean-Pierre Melville's Army of Shadows. The film opened in New York at the Film Forum last month. It's now in several major cities and will be more widely released in June. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
The 1969 French resistance epic Army of Shadows was never theatrically distributed in the United States, which is an incomprehensible lapse. It's a major film by a major director, Jean-Pierre Melville, and I'm not pronouncing it Melville because he borrowed his last name from Herman, and it's silly to Frenchify it. The American surname says a lot about Melville's inspirations. He's best known for Bob le Flambeur, Le Cercle Rouge, and Le Samurai, cool, sleek, American-style gangster films that had a huge influence on the French New Wave of the early 60s. And while Army of Shadows is far from Melville's gangster films in its setting, it has something of the same cool. This time, though, that cool has an undercurrent of despair. Army of Shadows is just short of 2.5 hours, and there's very little in the way of emotional release. It's episodic, and its exposition comes in dribs and drabs. It begins in the middle. We watch Gerbier, played by Lino Ventura, in a van being taken to a Nazi prison camp. He's a drab-looking man and difficult to read, and that, we learn, is by design. He will reveal nothing to his captors. The first section of the film is so deliberate that when he's subsequently taken to a German police station for what will surely be a brutal interrogation, it's a shock when he makes a violent escape. In the course of the next hour, we meet Gerbier's team of resistance spies in their furtive meetings, among them François, played by Jean-Pierre Cassel, the endlessly resourceful Mathilde, played by Simone Signoret, and the leader of the resistance, a logic professor played by Paul Maurice and clearly modeled on the legendary martyr Jean Moulin. There are no big missions here, no trains or bridges on the River Kwai to be blown up. In fact, the inevitability of defeat hangs in the air. And still these resistance fighters go on. They execute with both horror and resolve a young man who's betrayed them. They move people in and out of the country. They attempt to rescue a captured and tortured comrade, or failing that, to slip him a cyanide capsule so that he may end his own life. Army of Shadows is a procedural, a film in which much time is taken up with minutiae, how planes take off and land, how Gerbier parachutes at night back into the country after a stay in England. The more conventionally dramatic parts of the film don't always work. A decision of one character to martyr himself lacks both narrative and psychological clarity. And a relationship between two brothers who don't truly know each other seems overly literary. But the grim stoicism grows on you and becomes overwhelming. The time of the film is late gray autumn bordering on winter, and throughout you hear the distant howl of cold winds. Ventura was not on speaking terms with his director, and he incorporated his sense of isolation into his performance. There's something wrenching in this film's cool. It's as if Melville can't fully give vent to his own emotions, any more than the men and women in the French resistance could allow their anguish over what the Nazis had done to their country to inhibit their ability to function. Melville fought in the resistance himself and was reportedly devastated when he saw The Sorrow and the Pity, Marcel Ophüls' momentous 1970 documentary about the French who collaborated with the Nazis. In Army of Shadows, he holds those collaborators at arm's length. He can't seem to relate to them at all. It doesn't matter why they did what they did. They did it. And he and his comrades did what they had to do. The film is an indelible testament to people who acted and acted with honor in the absence of outside reinforcement or a larger faith in God. He might have called himself Melville, but Army of Shadows is French to the core. It's an existential masterpiece.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. He reviewed Army of Shadows, now playing in New York, Los Angeles, Washington, D.C., and Chicago. The film opens in other cities next month. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. We'll close with a song from Desmond Dekker. The reggae pioneer died Wednesday of a heart attack. He was 64. This is Israelites, recorded in 1969 and widely regarded as reggae's first worldwide hit. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Get up in the morning, slaving for bread, sir, so that every mouth can be fed. Oh, me Israelites, get up in the morning, slaving for bread, sir, so that every mouth can be fed.
Support for NPR comes from Delacorte Press, publisher of Sunstorm, a crime novel about a lawyer who is unexpectedly summoned back to her hometown in northern Sweden, by Asa Larson. From Judy and Steve Hopkins, supporting the Shakespeare Theater's production of Pericles, May 25th through June 4th, at the Carter Baron Amphitheater, Washington, D.C. And from the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide. On the web at fordfound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air for Memorial Day, inside the 86th Combat Support Hospital in Iraq, where doctors and nurses work feverishly to save soldiers' lives. We talk with John Alpert and Matthew O'Neill, filmmakers of the new documentary, Baghdad ER. Join us for the next Fresh Air.